Film and television production in Australia is booming. Spending on shows for kids is in free fall. It's terrible. But spending on adult drama made in Australia, telling Australian stories, is at a record. Over $1 billion last year, according to Screen Australia. But, and it's an almighty but, the hours made have collapsed. 500 hours of Aussie drama 25 years ago, but now only about 120. So much money being spent, so much of it public money, yet less and less to see for it. What to do about this has engaged the best minds in the industry for decades. Intricate arguments about tax breaks and subsidies are part of the story. But to look at the bigger picture, we've invited Anna Potter, professor at Queensland University of Technology, and author of a recent paper, Australian Television Drama's Uncertain Future, How Cultural Policy is Failing Australians. And with us also is Simon Nasht, former journalist with the ABC, for many years now, a prize-winning documentary maker. Welcome, Anna.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Welcome, Simon.
Thank you, David.
Now, can we be clear that we're not talking about the ABC, certainly not for the moment? We can get to the ABC, but we're talking about the industry, the commercial industry.
The screen industry. Yep.
The screen industry. Now, I wonder what is fundamental to the change. Firstly, the collapse of advertising revenue for commercial television stations. Anna.
Yes, that's been absolutely central to the crisis facing drama production, because Australia had a very unusual reliance on advertising revenue to fund national drama production, and combined with the use of content quotas on the three commercial broadcasters. So once advertising revenue began to drift and then, in fact, be in freefall towards online platforms, that took the most important source of investment for Australian drama out of the market. So that's been hugely significant. And that combined with the watering down of content quotas to the point that they don't really need to do drama anymore has contributed to the crisis that we're in.
So it's the same crisis facing newspapers, Simon.
Indeed. It's driven by a number of factors. Technology change is really one of the big ones, and we're yet to hit the biggest, the mother of them all is coming for us, which is AI. So who needs actors? Who needs archives? Who needs anything when you can just create it on a screen?
But we'll get to that.
We'll get to that.
But fundamental to our conversation today is that the rivers of advertising gold have gone elsewhere.
Absolutely. And they've gone primarily in the first instance to the international streaming platforms, which are, you know, basically technology companies that operate here. They raised revenue of about $4 billion in Australia last year, for which I might add they paid about 1% tax. Not bad when you get a bill from head office saying, well, we licensed everything to the Australian end.
It's better than the oil and gas industry.
Well,
Simon,
it's about the same, actually.
Don't complain.
It's about the same. That's a shocker, but that's a different issue. But it is, of course, now both Amazon and Netflix have advertising platforms on that are available. So that's just sucked it out of the commercial television.
Yes. And Anna, from the time that advertising revenues began to collapse, the commercial networks in Australia were lobbying government to be free of quota requirements.
Yes, I mean, they've been lobbying governments to be free from quota requirements forever, really, because they've always resented them because they were high cost. I should just clarify that ad revenue began to move away from commercial broadcasting well before the introduction of streamers.
Oh, yes.
From 2007, it started to go to search and social media. So the problem started well before the streamers entered the market. But yes, the commercial broadcasters whose business model was eroded by the introduction of their own multi-channels, in fact, that increased their programming costs but didn't generate any more ad revenue, and have always resented their high cost obligations, particularly to children, but also for drama and documentary. They redoubled their lobbying efforts. They're very competent at lobbying, and governments have always feared the kind of political and social power of commercial broadcasters. And that those efforts really came to a head in 2020 when the pandemic struck, and there was this sense that, you know, businesses were in terminal decline, and that led the children's quotas to be suspended and then removed entirely, and the drama quotas to be, the Morrison government watered down the drama quotas to the extent that they could be filled with a single episode of a kind of soap like Home and Away, whereas in the past the three commercial broadcasters said each had to invest in around 100 hours of Australian drama each.
So the three were producing 300 hours of Australian drama?
Approximately, yes, including soaps like Neighbours and Home and Away. So, that's high volume.
That all faded away. So mm-hmm. where did the makers of Australian stories go once that simple system collapsed?
I suppose a lot of them shifted their business models. So they moved away from drama towards reality entertainment, which was obviously the juggernaut, television juggernaut that entered our screens in the early 2000s. So companies like Southern Star, that had been enormous producers of Australian drama, pivoted to reality entertainment formats. A lot of them went out of business. And then the remainder turned their sights to the ABC, to SBS, and to from 2015, as the streamers entered the market, to the online streamers.
And Simon, you were part of that pivoting away.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the commercial broadcasting model kind of broke, as Anna says. It's reality TV or sport, really. A bit mm-hmm. of news on the side. That's it. That's their business as it stands. The ABC went through, as you know, under 11 years of Conservative government here, pretty much significant cuts. It's been significantly restored since, but it's still got a long way to go from where it was. SBS much the same. So you've got this contraction of the domestic market. And what's this all about? I mean, what's the real issue here is that Australian stories, our perspectives, our histories, our culture is not represented on screens as it was. And why is that a problem? Well, from tiny screens we hold in our hands to the IMAX cinemas we might go to, screens define culture now. And Australia's in this kind of interesting
position.
You're
talking to a writer, Simon, but keep going.
Well, we employ a lot of writers too, David, absolutely, and a lot of musicians and a lot of designers and a lot of, you know, it's a very...
Of course.
It's one of those industries that brings in the cultural milieu.
Yeah.
And the issue there, of course, is, strangely enough, being an English-speaking country, by and large, we are subject to the wealth of English-speaking programming out there. And by that, of course, I mean mostly American, the UK to some extent as well. But that can dump on our market. They can just, you know, sell their programs here for little cost. It's all cream for them because it's been financed from somewhere else. And that means that Australian perspectives, Australian stories, Australian take on our society is diminished. And that's not a good thing.
Anna, a bit of a declaration here. I know the people who made Heartbreak High, but let's take Heartbreak High as an example. Mm-hmm. This was made for international streamers. It was an international success. The two seasons that have gone to air, top 10 in 53 countries, et cetera, for both episodes. That's an Australian story being told to the world.
Like, when you say Australian story, it's an Australian story as in it was filmed in Australia, and it's obviously set in an Australian high school, and it's got a very diverse Australian cast. It's a wonderful show. I've enjoyed it hugely.
But are you quibbling about whether it's Australian?
No, I'm just making the point that when we did interviews, we did a lot of research with teenagers about how they felt about Heartbreak High, and they absolutely loved it. But they all pointed out that in Australia, students in high school don't wear their own clothes. They wear uniform. And so they felt that it had been made for international audiences. And so, yes, it's an Australian story and it went to the rest of the world. It's one small example made by a global conglomerate with, I think it went to three series in the end, but they're very short series.
The third series is about to dump in a couple
of weeks.
Yes,
I'm sorry. Yeah. So, no, I mean, Heartbreak High, yes, I think it's, I don't see a problem with Heartbreak High, except it was clearly made with an eye to international audiences as well as national audiences, but there's nothing wrong with that in this instance.
Simon?
Yeah, I think probably a better example for us to think about is the potential success that Australian film can have, film and television. Bluey, of course, is the perfect example, the world's most streamed program. Now, that comes
Donald
out of a
Trump,
Brisbane studio.
Donald Trump talks about Bluey.
Yeah, and there's nothing compromising in there that isn't very Australian, full of, you know, good lingo, a couple of dingoes, and, you know, not dingoes, sorry, you know, a couple of
cattle
Australian
dogs.
Thank you, cattle dogs. Thank you, Anna. And, you know, it projects to the world and it's loved because it's Australian. But it is a black swan in our industry. And I might point out that the organisation that benefits commercially from that, apart from the creators themselves, Ludo Studios, is BBC Studios, which is the economic arm of the BBC. And BBC Studios made a profit of over £220 million last year, so about $450 million Aussie dollars. Overall. But a very big driver of its incredible growth as BBC Studios has been Bluey. You know, it's not just the TV program. They've got, you know, they've now got an amusement park in Brisbane. They've got a publishing arm. They're doing games. They're doing all sorts of stuff on the back of that. Now, the ABC turned down that opportunity, unfortunately, because it didn't have the money to invest. That probably it rues that decision now, but it just simply didn't have the firepower.
But, Anna, what we're talking about here are exceptions to a situation which is addressing, which you are addressing and Simon is addressing here as well. One of the points that you make is that the money, the public money going in here, is often going in to prop up international production of international work, but in Australian studios employing Australians. Now, do you object to that?
I struggle with the level of public subsidy that goes into attracting international locations to film in Australia and the level of subsidy that goes into drama production that is subsequently paywalled behind streamer paywalls. Given that so much of the justifications for these subsidies are based on the preservation of Australian stories, the points that Simon's made about the importance of telling stories that locate us in our distinct cultural context, when many of these stories have very little cultural value and are actually being made primarily for export markets. So I think where I struggle is with the merging of the economic and cultural arguments. So if we're talking, and this is where some of the data compounds this issue, that we tend to talk about screen production in terms of the billions spent, as if more and more money spent is a better and better thing. But that doesn't really speak to the cultural value of the content that is being produced or the public value that is being returned to the taxpayer, whose taxes, let's face it, are increasingly propping up the costs of these forms of content, and who very well may well be unable to view them themselves because they'll be behind a streamer paywall. So it's the mixing together of the cultural and the economic that I think requires scrutiny and is problematic.
I would agree with you, Anna. I think fundamentally we've got a problem here that the system we've developed, which I must say as a producer in Australia is by international standards pretty generous in many ways. I mean, we get tax write-offs, we get various subsidies, but the system is now no longer fit for purpose. A couple of good examples. David, you will know some of the principals in this. A grouping of some of Australia's finest drama producers started a company a decade or so ago called Matchbox. Amongst them, Tony Ayres and Penny Chapman and many other fine creative
people. People
you know well. They made it successful enough to actually sell it to NBC Universal, 100% sold. Our national screen agency, our cultural agency, Screen Australia, subsidised a lot of that production, mm-hmm. Not just for Matchbox, but many other companies as well. I just don't get why our national cultural agency is handing over soft public money to some of the world's biggest conglomerates, tech platforms and media organisations. It doesn't make any sense for me and that's what Anna says, they have blurred the business and the cultural imperatives. Now, a lot of people get employed on these big overseas movies that get shot here. They do. But they get paid Hollywood rates, and then if you're making an Australian drama or an Australian documentary for that matter, I cannot afford to hire the cinematographers and editors at the rates that those studios are paying. And so where's the benefit in that? I don't see it. And there's lots of contradictions we've built into the system now.
Anna?
I think Simon makes a really important point here around the structural changes to the production sector and indeed to the whole business of television, in that so much of the Australian, what we think of as the Australian independent production sector, because it's independent from broadcasters, is now owned by global conglomerates, including, as was Matchbox Pictures. And That ownership really moves those production companies into global financing and distribution arrangements, which is often much to their advantage and is not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, Matchbox for years made superb, very Australian drama and were supported and enabled to do so by their international partner, by their international ownership structure. So much of the sector is now part of those international ownership arrangements. And that means that the IP of the programs that are made and the subsidies for those programs are owned by companies that operate outside Australia, have global economies of scale, and will move production very easily depending on where the most attractive location incentives are. So we've sort of handed over the industry, the industry has been largely acquired. You're absolutely right, Simon. Some accountant in Los Angeles decided that one of Australia's most iconic and wonderful production companies, Matchbox Pictures, was no longer viable.
What's this company we've got in Australia for? There's no tax write off on that for us. Get rid of it.
And they shut it down a month or so ago.
Dozens of people lost their job.
But it was a vehicle for making Australian drama for Australians. It was a vehicle. What are the other vehicles, okay, Simon?
Here's an alternative. It's, you know, Blind Freddy can work this one out.
I've always loved
Blind Freddy. Blind Freddy's one of the best producers in the business, David.
Connoisseur of film. Go on.
If you're going to get the subsidies from the tax write-offs and the soft grant money, make sure the IP is 51% Australian owner. Those companies will come to Australia, those international companies, to feed their global distribution pipelines, but keep the ownership of the smarts, the cultural value, in Australian hands. They'll come anyway because we're really good at what we do and we're very cost effective. And so they will line up to come, but don't just hand them everything. It's just mad. And then give them a fat tax subsidy for it. I mean, that's nuts. It makes no sense whatsoever. And we've stuck with the system. That decision was taken 15 years or so ago at a board meeting at Screen Australia. There was no industry consultation. It staggered everybody at the time.
Which decision?
It's just locked in there.
Which decision?
The decision to allow soft taxpayer funds to go to foreign-owned companies.
Right. But Anna, would you be suggesting that foreign-owned companies not be allowed to take any kind of public subsidy?
No, not at all. But I think we have to acknowledge that there is a distinction between a production company that has the resources of Fremantle Media behind it or NBCU behind it and a small production company that is operating entirely independently and possibly look at weighting those offsets differently to reflect the very significant resources that one company has behind it and that one company doesn't. So I don't think that foreign ownership on its own is a dreadful thing, and it has enabled many companies to scale up and to get Australian stories to the rest of the world and to make wonderful drama with cultural value. Foreign ownership in itself is not a terrible thing, but given the global kind of correction in drama investment and the risk aversion that is so present now because of the costs of drama, we really have to think about whether those small independent production companies should get more support given the very different conditions in which they're operating at the moment.
Simon, that was a point that we were talking about, which is that the cost of making film and television goes through the roof every year, and public money does not match that.
Exactly. And the outcome of that we can see not only with a Matchbox closing down, but elsewhere in the food chain in film and television. One of the largest post-production facilities in the country, a company that's been operating for more than 30 years, Cutting Edge, closed down. It has studios in three cities and a lot of people lost their work. And they're at the end of the pipeline. There's not enough production coming through. And if there's not the edit suites and colour graders and et cetera, they don't have the work anymore. We did a survey in the industry late last year to bring some data to the facts. And about 1,200 people were, in every Australian electorate in the industry, were asked their opinions of how they were going. A third are planning to leave the industry. 25% of them can't pay their bills. I mean, it's a largely contractor, short-term business, and they go feast or famine. And at the moment, it's famine to famine. And that's an industry in crisis. That really is an industry that government, the state and federal screen agencies and cultural agencies are not recognising the scale of the problem we've got. If we want to hear Australian voices and see them, hear our stories and export our great stories to the world and the soft power and diplomacy that goes with that, we have to shake this system up. It's not fit for purpose.
Anna, what's your prescription for shaking the system up?
Well, I think a lot depends on what problem we're trying to solve here. So if we want to shake the system up to ensure that Australians have Australian stories available to them, then we have to look at, well, where's the demand for those stories going to come from and on what platforms are Australians going to be able to access them? That's one problem challenge that sort of prioritises the Australian community who's footing the bill for a lot of this stuff. The second problem is how do we deal with an industry that is being disrupted in just the way that taxi drivers were or education currently is? We're dealing with the impacts of digital disruption, which are only going to get more intense with as AI becomes more and more present in production processes. So there are two kind of quite complex problems here. One is, how do we make sure stories are made and available to audiences? And a second problem is, how do we support an industry that's in crisis? And we can't, unfortunately, not all industries are going to survive in the way that they were because of the scale of the disruption that the media industry, you know, look at how many jobs have gone from journalism. This is not something that can be easily solved by increasing the taxpayer burden on these industries.
What about addressing the issue of what is and isn't Australian? Is Baz Luhrmann's Elvis film, honoured as it's been with many prizes, is that Australian?
I think there are ways of defining it, David, that are pretty clear. It's the creative control. Is it being taken by Australians? It doesn't have to be gum leaves and koalas. It can be Elvis. But is it creatively controlled by Australians? Is it written? Is it directed? Is it produced? And is the benefit owned by Australians? Now, you can set up a, you know, 10-buck ABN and call yourself an Australian company. And, of course, that's what these international companies do. But that's not the beneficial ownership and control. So we've got to look at it if there's not enough public money to go around. Of course there's not. We're better off spending it on Australian cultural projects, but they can be about anything in the world. I fought for years to overcome an anomaly in the system that meant when I went to make a documentary that might have been at Gallipoli or the Australian Antarctic Division or wherever it would be, it wouldn't be suitable for the subsidy system.
Because it wasn't geographically.
Because it wasn't set. And I said, that's mad. And in fact, we got a clause that's actually called the Gallipoli Clause to change that sort of silly position. I mean, you couldn't film on Kokoda Track and call it Australian. That was crazy. So we got that one changed because it made sense.
Can I just jump in? Because I do struggle with the definition of something being under Australian creative control and with Australians in lead creative roles as ergo, meaning that it's an Australian story. Because you could have a story that's located in America, like Elvis, but also like series like Clickbait or Good Cop, Bad Cop on Stan, that are literally American stories. I mean, they're located in other countries, but they're made with Australian creative labour and under Australian creative control. And I think now, given the extent to which the business is internationalised and the extent to which global streamers are sort of dominating screen production, I don't think that creative control is a strong enough definition anymore because it doesn't safeguard an Australian story. And I know these are really difficult conversations, and I know that a definition of Australian is almost impossible to settle on. And I know that it's kind of tempting to say, oh, you mean we've got to put kangaroos and koalas in everything we make? And I'm not advocating that. But we need stories that speak directly to the Australian experience and are rooted in Australian culture as much as we need, wonderful as they are, movies like Elvis.
But how do you, as you propose, how do you separate industry support from cultural objectives? How do you do that without sort of, you know, making it subject to gum leaves and kangaroos?
Or bureaucratic influence, basically.
Yes.
You know, let the bureaucrats decide what that is. That's not a good idea.
Well, you ask yourself, could this story be made and set anywhere else? Or could it only be made and set in Australia? And if it's the latter, then you give it a greater amount of public support. You may even need to fully fund it because you may not be able to get international investors on board. But if it's a story that literally, and you know, a lot of First Nations drama would fall into this category, but there are other stories as well. If it literally could not be made anywhere else, if it speaks directly to the issues and challenges facing Australian society, then it deserves a greater level of public support, rather than if it's something made with Australian creative talent, but it could be set anywhere in the world.
Yeah, I think the notion of what you're talking about, Anna, is a carve out for those particular stories that would be a level of funding. Yes, yeah. And I think we could, it's not beyond us to be able to create something that works sensibly in that regard. I mean, I couldn't make most of the documentaries I make because they're about Australian issues. Mm-hmm. I'm working with David with one at the moment, full disclosure.
Full disclosure. I'm going to be quizzed for 6 hours on Friday about the Tampa, for God's
about
sake.
About 25 years of the Tampa coming up. Now, yes, it's actually a global story as it turns out, but you know, we're not going to get a big subsidy from America to make a sale on the Tampa story, nor many of the things I do, but they have great importance and relevance for Australian audiences. So, yes, I think you're right, Anna. There are degrees of this. The one thing I wouldn't like to do is put that in either in the hands of the lawyers or the bureaucrats to decide what that process is. We need a kind of, a straightforward definition of what our objectives are there. But it's part of what I'm talking about. It's part of the shakeup. If we want to retain these kinds of programs, then we need to look at how we fund them. I'll give you a good example to test us all about how we think it would work. Would a Matchbox production, The Slap, based on a great Australian novel?
Yes.
Would that qualify? It's a story of domestic story. It could have taken place in other places and, in fact, was remade in other languages.
Oh, has it been?
Yes, it was. It was. Just took the Australian scripts and then revoiced them, I think, reworked them for Greece or Holland or somewhere, I think. So,
honestly, it reeks of Melbourne to me.
Yeah, well, it does if you've grown up in a Greek Australia. Absolutely, really interesting. But it's a personal story. But so is a film like Lantana or these are global relevance, but
because they're about human beings.
They're about human beings, but they also have a very Australian kind of feel to them, almost a smell to them, don't
now,
they?
Now, a last question to you both. Is there anyone who can fix these problems listening to the industry, Anna?
I think that the industry has been listened to a great deal, and that is why we have measures like local content obligations on streamers that come without cultural protection, so will generate economic activity without necessarily telling Australian stories. I think the industry has been listened, or that's unfair actually. Parts of the industry have been listened to, powerful voices in the industry have been listened to. And that's why we've seen some kind of increase in subsidies and obligations placed on streamers. But I think perhaps whose voices haven't been listened to and whose views are often overlooked in this is the Australian community whose taxes are funding so much of this stuff. What kind of Australian stories does the community want and value? Because their viewing habits suggest that they equally value international stories, given the very high take-up of streaming services, particularly Netflix, and audiences' lack of concern really about the low levels of Australian content in their catalogues. So it's less perhaps that we need to listen to industry stakeholders who clearly have a vested interest, because quite reasonably they have businesses to run. And perhaps we start asking Australians what kinds of stories they'd like to hear and on which platforms they would like to access them.
Simon.
Yeah, I think so. I think your predecessor in that chair, Philip Adams, David.
Titan of the film industry.
Many, many years ago helped create a new Australian film industry. There had been previous iterations right back to the 1920s, but he actually rebuilt it by forcing us to have a good think about what we wanted to see. And I think Anna's right. I think we've got to listen to audiences. I do think it's at a moment that we need to do these considerations, because things like what's going to be brought by AI, what streaming and paid-for content is changing. And, of course, inevitably, the rise of YouTube, which is about half of all screen viewing now. Mm-hmm. It's a time now to think, what do we want to achieve? And the problem I don't see is that the cultural czars are actually in a space where they think, okay, it's time now to have another look at how we create all of this. There's no votes to be lost by making Australian stories, so government shouldn't be scared of it. But we do need a big rethink, I think.
Okay, you two titans, we have to leave it there. Thanks for joining us on Late Night Live. I've been speaking to Professor Anna Potter from the Queensland University of Technology and to Simon Nasht, former completely respectable journalist who now makes documentaries. Thanks so much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you, David.
Thank you.
Thank you.